Hello. Welcome to the Michigan Writers Series. My name is Michael Rodriguez. I'm a humanities librarian here. In coordination with Peter Berg, who is the head of Special Collections, and Stephanie Matheson and myself, we all help to administer the Michigan Writers Series. Tonight, you'll have a reading from Joe Matuszak, and following, there'll be a question and answer period if you have questions. Joe Matuszak's poetry, fiction, and essays have appeared in the Georgia Review, Kansas Quarterly, Passages North, Controlled Burn, Contemporary Michigan Poets, and other magazines and anthologies. His book of poems, Eating Fire, is forthcoming from Ridgeway Press. He has worked in the Creators in the Schools program and was director of the Arts Wire, a program of the New York Foundation of the Arts, has taught in the Master of Arts Administration program of the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, directed a multidisciplinary artist cooperative organization, managed a computer software store for 5 years, co-directed the Genesee Literary Center, and helped organize community-based literary activities for more than a decade. That's quite a list to say.
In other words, I haven't figured out what I want to be when I grow up yet. So.
He has also organized and moderated programs with Poets on Poetry for Public Access Television and was a writer and art reviewer for the Flint Journal for 4 years. His writing has received a Creative Artists Award and a Hopwood Award, and the Hopwood Award from the University of Michigan. He serves as a technology consultant specializing in nonprofit concerns and is frequently featured at conferences both in the United States and abroad. This summer, Joe has been working on a community knowledge project as an artist in residence in the Clinton Township Library in Lenawee County, where he lives with his wife, poet Josie Kearns. Please welcome Joe Matuszak.
Thank you. I'm going to start out by reading some pieces from Eating Fire, and then I thought I would read a couple from the next manuscript that I'm working on, which is called An American Tarot, and then finally a couple of miscellaneous and or newer pieces. And being the, I guess, who I am, I'd like to start with a poem that I'll just sort of dedicate it to the general American attitude about going to war with Iraq. This is an older piece, but it's kind of a complaint, I guess, about myself in particular and my ability or lack of ability to go deep enough into the truth of things. It's a poem called Surface. Amazing is how the spindly bug dances on water, not how deep he should plunge, and so it is with the world. I say lip gloss, miracle diet, latex paint. I say better the review than the movie or book. I say tanned skin and not muscle or dismal dogged bone, and celebrity endorsement rather than product, telegenic candidates and not thorny issues, the smile and not the heart, for who can trust the heart? Let someone else have the intangible, the deep and everlasting, the complete. I want what is palpable, long rows of exactly how it seems, of just in from the coast of read my lips. Hooray for saved at the last moment. Boo for how stupid in the first place. Give me a formula I can recognize where I feel safe, not unexpected side effects from common household objects, sofa pillows accumulating in alarming numbers in landfills, stupid Brazilian development thinning the atmosphere, the homeless, hopeless, uneducated, and insane, trendy restaurants in Japan serving whale meat, Zsa Zsa Gabor, Dan Quayle, oh, lead me out of this cornucopia of information and import, dropkick me, Jesus, in front of primetime TV, feed me the cliches I am comfortable with, play the same song on the radio day after static day. Lie to me, lie to me, I'm a Toys R Us kid. It's like St. Peter. If you think about what you're doing, then the water won't hold you up, and I'm wearing my best fancy suit. It's dry clean only. Sorry, I've just been reading too much of politics. So this is, I figure I'll start them out with, I'll start out with a couple of rather light pieces and then I'll get, you know, like really dismal. So this is another, I guess, of the same kind of structurally of poems, in that it's a bit of a rant, which I'm known to go into on occasion, even though it's not all of what I do. This is this has the rare quality of almost all being true, which, you know, I mean, I don't usually do, where, you know, I mean, they usually have some truth in them, but, you know, exaggeration for poetic concerns is always important. This actually is a fairly narrative poem. Most of it is literally true in terms of it happened exactly in this sequence and so on. And this is dedicated for my my traveling companions during the initial part of this piece. Paula Terry, who was the director of disability issues for the National Endowment for the Arts, and Bill Cleveland, who's a wacky consultant. Who, you know, specializes in what's called the open spaces model, if you know what that is. So this is called Jurassic Poem. Maybe it was nearly running out of gas, an hour plus out of Bismarck, North Dakota, thinking about fossil fuel with needle registering below empty, staring at a huge fiberglass and concrete cow perched on one of the stark hillsides and imagining walking several miles for more gas. But I'm there in Dickinson, the self-proclaimed queen of the prairie, at the Hospitality Inn. And while I'm checking in, everyone goes off to the Dakota Dinosaur Museum without me. The advertisement proclaimed 10 full-scale dinosaurs and more. Albertosaurus, Orinthomomus, Edmontosaurus, and Stegosaurus. This was fine until Paula and I decided to go later and the museum was closed despite its posted hours. We tried again and the same thing happened. It depressed me immeasurably. Now, I don't really care much about dinosaurs, other than the fact that some of my close personal friends have a lot in common with dinosaurs, and everyone at the hotel said we'd get there, look at them, and be bored, like they were after about half an hour. It was more that the idea of the stupid things got wedged into my brain and wouldn't leave me alone. I kept thinking of a story John Katarsky told me about a friend whose wife didn't believe at all in dinosaurs, and John relating, he went kind of berserk, going, "What? She doesn't believe in dinosaurs?" This from a man who with his girlfriend took turns hurling furniture through windows over how hot a perfect bath should be. "I can't imagine it. How can you live with a woman who doesn't believe in dinosaurs?" And his friend looked at him and said, John, you know, it doesn't come up that often. For me, it doesn't come up at all. But here, there I was with this, must I say it, primordial itch I couldn't scratch. And the next day, I was in Louisiana, surrounded by swamps while talking with people about cyberspace and telecommunications. But all I could think of was about dinosaurs, and how they would have loved the place, how the gorgeous hummingbirds would be like little after-dinner mints to them. And I couldn't sleep for imagining huge, cold-blooded bodies sloshing through the swamps, not at all minding the 95 degrees and humidities. And then next, I was heading to Washington, D.C. in a jet that was burning fossil fuel, plants, and bodies, huge gallon by huge gallon, remembering a large mammoth skeleton that was discovered near Flint, Michigan, and some green reporter asking if there was anything unusual about it. And later in a story quoting Doc Wilson saying, yes, well, this is the first time we've ever seen a mammoth wander this close to an expressway. But now here I am in D.C. reading the paper about all the doings of Congress. And if that doesn't make you think about dinosaurs, I mean, my God, what will? So I'm hurrying fast as I can to the Smithsonian Museum of Natural History to see the skeletons I know are waiting. But before I get there, I run into the Festival of American Folklife and hear the Six Nation women singers do some powwow songs. I'm somewhat distressed that I missed the social dance songs, even though I hadn't planned on any of this, but suddenly it starts raining and I'm accosted by an elderly gentleman in a red and white striped umbrella hat who's handing out leaflets and wearing a placard that asks, are you being mind controlled? And I want to say, yes, yes, it's the stupid dinosaurs. They're caught in the La Brea tar pit of my brain and they've settled deep into my bones. Okay. All right, enough of that kind of thing, I think. Every once in a while, it's kind of fun to just sort of like go off on a tangent and see how far you can run with it. And I find, actually, those kinds of pieces a great deal of fun to write, just because you can go anywhere with them, basically. I guess I'll go in a slightly different direction. This is probably a bit more typical, I guess, of some of my work. And then it started with reading Joseph Campbell's The Hero with a Thousand Faces, which is a brilliant book on hero myths. And in that book, he relates a Hopi Indian myth called the myth of Water Jug Boy, who has, his mother's making a pot and gets a shard in her leg and becomes pregnant. It's a classic kind of myth like that, and gives birth to this boy in the shape of a water jug. And there's all these adventures that he has rolling down the pass following the kids. And he's accepted normal as being fairly normal in the tribe. And it's kind of like a I guess to some extent, like a Hopi Indian version of Pinocchio to some extent, how he becomes human and all this stuff. So I started thinking, I'm a Flint kid. How would I translate that into kind of an urban idiom? What would that be? And how can I do it in such a way that I'm not being completely culturally insensitive, other than in an intentional way? And so I started thinking, well, where I grew up, what would be there? Well, it'd be junk. Okay, it was a junky place. So that's sort of where this piece came from. It's called Rust. Doorbell, quick rustling, and a basket moored to top step with dismal note, please look after my child, please care and nurture, build, make strong. Christ, I thought, what a city, what a world, then peeled back the basket's grayed linen cover. Inside lay only piles of silvery bolts and brassy pins, heaps of screws with stripped threads, scruff and slivers, little odd grinds of steel and bent aluminum bars. Another crank, another joke, something for the trash heap. But as I closed my door, there floated out a whimper, small like far-off radio or neighbor's muffled telephone. I searched across the room, couldn't find the source, but still that crying remained, coming from the basket, vibrating, sputtering like a misfed engine. No directions, so I assembled pieces the best I could. When finished, I had a baby made of all these odd parts, but kicking and gurgling like any other, grasping with metal hand and shiny eyes to take in all the world. So I reared that child as my own, clothed and fed it, cleaned and taught. When time came, the child went to school, was taunted for its differences, cried greasy tears, and my fears were those of any parent. A metal child grows in dangerous ways, stray dents and quick patches, magnetism and soldering. Many times the child returned home late, and attached I'd see another dingy bolt or loose hinge, some worrisome spike or blinking contradictory panel, and I would tighten, sand, polish, oil, and scrape until the child would scream, "No, I like it just the way it is." And I'd hear that damned hinge squawk and squeak all night, and the child would rock itself, jitter, and howl with delight. Time, 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 I now feel myself turning to metal, this voice raspy with the grind of worn parts, back a string of frozen phalanges. What mother, what father gave up this child to me? What kind of city stamps impressions on it like a factory? Outside, it is raining, a downpour that goes on forever. The child I assembled rusts in spite of my love. This is, I'm going to read, I think, the title piece from this book called Eating Fire. And it has an odd kind of story about its genesis as well, in that the first line is just completely stolen, as is the title. I happened to be at a meeting in, I forget where it was, someplace near Detroit, and there was a magic shop opening across the street. And so my friend and I went over and went down, and I came across this book. It was called Eating Fire. And I thought, oh, this is great. I opened it up, and the first line of this was the first line of the introduction. And I was like, oh, what a great starting piece. So I went back like 2 days later to buy the book because I didn't have enough cash with me at the time. And it was gone. And I spent 10 years looking for this stupid book. And I've never managed to track it down. But the heck with it. I've stolen the first line, and it's mine at this point. And I should also note that just from a kind of writerly conceit, I always wanted to end a poem on a parentheses. So that was sort of the task that I set myself, which sounds stupid, and probably is. But what the heck. Eating fire, and I'll just give the quote for the first line. Eating fire. I first started eating fire for money. Quick sips of butane and bottled beer, small bets in the bar with drunks. But then I grew to love the taste, the raw and acrid burn as it extinguishes. Every day I chew the fruits of the earth, fill myself with water and air to stay alive. But it is fire that stokes the engine, fire that is the hamster on the wheel, fire that brings me closer to the ash I will become. I have saturated my body with the honeyed smell of arson, sweet and volatile as religious rumor, holy cool tongues dancing like lozenges made of fireflies. When Moses first saw the burning bush, he ran away, driven not by fear but desire, sweet tremor, and when he returned, reached his hand into the inferno and began to pluck and then consume the fiery berries. Branch by flaming branch, he ate the rest and smoldered with the unnameable. When he tried to describe the texture, everything came out as law. I think I'll do a couple more from this book and then go on to another. I wrote a series of pieces. I have a tendency to like obsess on particular subjects, so I did a series of pieces on music. I did a series of pieces on paintings and whatnot. And I thought I would read a couple of the music ones, just because I still like them, even though they're a bit old for me at this point. This one actually comes from reading an interview with Jean Cocteau in defense of difficult art was one of his things, but he was also talking about the making of his movie Orpheus, and if any of you have seen it, Orpheus is a wonderful, wonderful film, and it was done long enough ago pre-industrial light and magic, so special effects were all very different. And there's one scene where Orpheus puts his hand into the mirror. Cocteau talks about how that was done. And how it was done is they built the set sideways. And they got a big vat of mercury because you could put your hand in mercury and it wouldn't, like, shake. It would just, you know, it's a heavy metal. So, and he talked about everyone on the set was terrified about this for two reasons. First, they were terrified that this vat would break and the mercury would go all over and they'd be poisoned because it's highly toxic. Second, they were terrified that the vat would break and the mercury would go all over and they'd have to stop shooting because they'd go broke because they couldn't return the mercury. So they had the actor just, like, you know, wear a big long glove and stick his hand in. So I don't know how exactly or why, but I mean, sometimes I listen to music a lot while I'm writing, and I just happened to be listening to heavy metal while I was reading about this heavy metal. So that's where this came from. And of course, it's a love poem. I should probably mention that just obtusely. It is important to stay dangerous and preferably transparent, like that broken tumbler writhing at fingers in the soapy water, like that cough of wind which shears jets into the ground. This is why when we smile, we threaten to bite, show incisors, if not intent, and why we say, I love you. The man speeding from a cannon imagines two trajectories, one a graceful arc to the net, the other directly to the face of a woman in the crowd, her eyes widening in fascination and horror as his body hurtles toward hers. Perhaps she will move. Perhaps they will kiss and die. Perhaps each has the same velocity. Let us watch television. Let us dip our glove in poison. No, in mercury, as in Cocteau's Orphée, so it will disappear and not rustle the surface, but only displace the depths. Let us imagine our hands invisible and able to cause tears, waiting for movie music to crescendo, a scream, the lurker, strange camera angle. Here, hold my hand. Have I told you lately that you are like cholesterol? My heart is so full of you, it threatens to choke and stop. Little death, big death. This is why we must stay together. I thought maybe I would, read this one simply. This is essentially a stolen piece. It's a story I stole from a host of mine when I was in Ireland. So this is a piece with apologies to Linda Henderson, whose story it truly is. But, you know, hey, what's the line? Bad poets imitate, great poets steal outright. Or bad artists, I guess it is. So this is called Poaching with Darby and Happy Harry. The boat is borrowed, so no loss if seized, as it follows low tide out on this moonless night. Darby's arms at 65 are rock tight from a lifetime of stealth, and he slides the oars as if the water were butter, churning no telltale splashes that might alert the game wardens. I stand on shore and hold one end of the net again, so if someone's caught, it's me. And then, in the black, stale breath of the night, the tide changes, and the first fish arrows, panic-stricken, into the net. Every strum of his tail travels like a chord up the sinew to play this song. The business of poaching is killing. And maybe just one more from here, and then I'll go on. This is also one that's more or less true, and this was, I guess I'll read it just because this poem annoyed me to no end, and to be worked upon, and it went anywhere from like half of this size to literally being 20 pages long to being back to being a small little piece like it probably deserves to be. So it's called Voyeur. All that summer, I perched in my favorite battered, once white chair, straining for a voice to boom out grand and perfect, grow from that dumb murmur draping my waking life, to tell me something true. But night after fan-cooled night, while anger rivered my childhood streets and the Milky Way the sky, while Mr. Cat slowly scythed the neighborhood clean of any animal slow or dumb, passing cat or foolish rabbit, pheasant, yes, urban raccoon or opossum who dared near the wild catnip patch out back. I wanted most for the physical therapy students upstairs to start screwing again with this month's boyfriends, crashing off couch or bed to hardwood floor and admonishing, slow down, damn it, slow down, oh yes, while I held still, wondered if my wife and I carried to heaven as our neighbors did to earth, better Congress than loud stereos dueling driveway arguments over parking. Quiet below, listening to the other roommate upstairs creep closer, she spying, me picturing slitted doors, tossed rumpled clothing, one friend panting shallowly, watching two laughing others engaged. Can I explain how little I knew, how little still, tunneled ever deeper into night, my tiny solar system revolving on the far edge of a huge, wide galaxy of movement, circles within circles within. That house is gone. The whole neighborhood, really, leveled for a green belt, given back to animals. But part of me still hangs there, second story, invisible above the ground, because that quavering squeak of wood beneath the roommate's secretive heel, that furtive glance to see if she's been heard while sneaking ever closer, that held breath, that muffled creak and pause was all I've ever understood about the soul. I'm going to do a couple from An American Tarot and then just a couple short others, I guess. I have to say that in some ways, the couple that I'm going to read, I find to be different pieces now than when I wrote them, because these were actually written pre-September 11th. The first time I read them after September 11th, I was really, I found them bothersome, shall I say, just in terms of how they tacked things. So this is a poem. The idea behind this is basically I wanted to create a new tarot deck. So all the pieces are like tarot cards that don't exist, but that could exist and should exist, and somehow, for me, summon up the American idiom in a way that isn't quite there. So this is a poem called The Survivor. Lone hand grasping skyward through the remade landscape of fast avalanche snow, only head bobbing like an indefensible wish, intact years past childhood in a vast roiling sea, after the great blue boat breaks quickly apart, after the wayward overloaded jet wears its sudden water wings, or perhaps the solitary figure who wanders dazed but unhurt as twin cars smolder, wrapped frond-like around far oak. But somehow you appear unsmudged after everyone else has broken, after the cancer, the political kidnapping, after the head-on swerve to avoid who we mostly are, that sudden explosive internal collision, after the epidemic, the endless pointless war, after your bastard father fucked you not so secretly for oh so many years, maybe luck, maybe happenstance, maybe a slight trick of low spectrum light or weird genetics or the restorative power of rock and roll, but yours becomes always the high quavering voice testifying through dark radio news, blotchy face caught in sharp focus on the bouncing handheld, scared yet striding surely to safety while the shimmering whatever does whatever in the background, explaining just how it is you come to be you, how it feels, the you who is here right now, how it feels like a glide across a bright, smooth plate of fresh cracked ice, or emerging carefully through a thin, frightening layer of bone ash, and how perhaps we might manage to do the same. This is called Crowd. Concrete and steel moorings shake, whole stadiums sections flex in rhythm, old oak floorboards rumble with the stomp of many feet. With one voice that is not a voice, but a metallic hive-like buzz, highway roar of multicolored sedans arrowing down a thoroughfare at separate destinations. The crowd throws down its runes, watches them bounce and spin, and clamors for someone within to divine what has been said. 10, 40, 60,000 faces swirling like a human sandstorm, no single set of features distinct. Rush the frenzied concert stage, parade against cautionary oil-dark tanks, rampage through neighborhood store windows thrown open like trash cans at the mercy of hungry urban raccoons, beat past two lightly policed wooden barricades, leaving always an unlucky few trampled in the wake, or stand unmoving in silent vigil, forlorn, with long candles and homegrown roses outside the empty house of the fallen hero. Perhaps there is an element overlooked, high on the periodic chart, so complex it only exists for brief durations, recombinant and random, that waves torn flags, chants some certain slogan, and binds itself to a trepidary song that blossoms and blooms like an aneurysm in the frantic group brain. Here you are, a body, in a body comprised of many bodies, corporal corpuscle in a rushing stream of blood, pushing and pumping toward the heart that may or may not be your own. Your fortune is found in the trembling red chambers of that organ, feeding glorious revolution, celebration, or rampaging mob, martyr or criminal or victim or anonymous nothing, and whether you will swim within or against it, you have only this next collective heartbeat to decide. I think two more pieces, and these are both outside of these manuscripts. This is, find it. Yeah, there it is. Sorry about this, I hate doing this. This is a poem that is written after a painting that's in the Museum of Modern Art by Domenico Gnoli. And I should probably reference that this is in reaction to a wonderful piece by Richard Tillinghast, which I guess is an adaptation by him of a Turkish poet. Called Table, which if you're familiar with the piece, it's a wonderful, wonderful piece. And it talks about, you know, the table and what's on there and all this. But this is the title of this is Without a Still Life, which is the name of the Gnoli piece. So, and part of it literally, that's what it is. It's a table. So Without a Still Life. Tablecloth cloth covered with nothing but reference. tableau of table and nothing else. Lack of pear, of apple, of light transforming into something more than they are not, or into so precisely themselves. Taken away now, that small collision with context, tinny echoes of pictorial reference to ground this arrangement in history. No bread, no cheeses, no grapes, no theater programs, newspapers, or telephones. Ladled off is the ever-cooling soup and bowl, abandoned for just this held-breath moment, missing also the single transfigured red rose that signals the transitory, emphatic cut stem, solitary thorn, mysterious prism of vase whose emotionless glass holds water to preserve before the painting preserves. No ball, no coin, no bottle of wine, no pheasant, no cat, no carefully tossed hat that has journeyed long and longer in the implied world. Not a single shadow, a fluctuation in the surface, the cloth flat and featureless as a low drone. We sit down to dinner, then, to this truly immovable and unmoving feast. You and I. And I only until this final word. I think what I'll end on is a kind of, to some extent, a jumping off point for me. I'm 2 weeks away from leaving for 10 weeks in northern Thailand for a writing retreat. And one of the things I'm going to be working on is basically, it's great, I'll go overseas to write about trips I've taken overseas kind of thing. And this is kind of an example of the, of some of what I've been doing. I've spent a lot of time in the last decade doing international travel to some very interesting places. This particular piece is set or comes from Bogota, Colombia, when I was down there. And I'd like to thank you all for your patience, and I guess we'll do questions after this. This is called Hotel Bogota. Half the night in the darkened hotel bar, I buy drinks whose Spanish names I don't know for German theater technicians whose gay dance version of Othello my young guide so desperately encourages me to take her to see, having heard reports of people fainting in the aisles. Amaranda, beautiful and earnestly angry beyond tact at the modern flamenco dancers from Spain, whose performance we've all just left early because she knows the difference, practices her English, lodged for the moment with us here in this faux deco Hollywood nightmare of a lounge, posters of unknown B-movie from the 1960s plastered everywhere and somehow made to look cheaper than they already are, while outside right now armed troops twitch nervously in the street like extras from one of those movies, only younger, more scared, with reason. Around us, the city smashes open like a ripe melon on hot pavement. Here scatter the bright yellow seeds of the future, looking for fallow ground. Packed tight as dynamite, absorbent fossils shouting outward. Here squirts the sweet pulp of a high mountain fruit with a name like a ceremony, mystical and obtuse. Between the tents and numerous soldiers, the homeless with open sores and actual rags for clothes, and the drivers who take traffic law as a personal affront. Here on the plains of God, cut high in the north of this city, which is exploding with people who stream in from the battered countryside, the artists dance until enforced curfew beneath a huge striped tent where security screams out those unbadged. 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, they dance and dance and dance. It is not a mixture of fear and joy, just joy and sex and alcohol. On Palm Sunday, hundreds of thousands of people litter the pitted avenues with palms and sway singing to welcome the Savior. The poor twist these tropical limbs into complex decorations, tiny hanging houses of frond topped by elaborate tanned stars, and press them to passing cars, hoping for a favor in return. In a week, the story goes, there is resurrection, renewal. It is impossible to imagine that the wheel will not turn. Thank you. It's Q&A time. How do we do this? Anyone have anything that you would like to know or ask? Oh, the ringer. Yes.
I do have a question. Do you think that your poetry is clairvoyant? I mean, I haven't heard those two poems before.
You?
In the tarot section? I mean, it's out of the tarot section, but what do you think about that?
You mean I like Joe Psychic Poet? No, I don't. I wish. I mean, you know, and frankly, I'd probably make a better income if it were actually true. But no, I don't. I think I think that it justifies what I was trying to do with the project, which is look at kind of, you know, big themes that I think resonate. I think
they really are different poems.
Yeah, that's yeah. It's kind of.
I
know, and that was certainly obviously not there when I wrote them, but and it has, I think that's an interesting issue though in general is how history changes literature, or how history changes the way that we look at things, because the way that we look at things, we look at it differently than we would have a year plus ago, automatically. So.
I wonder, related to those two poems, I had two small art shows in D.C. past year, and I have been working with the image of the Statue of Liberty since about 1999. And the first show was in April, and the second one was in summer. And the word after the April show was, I had a, you know, a small group of work that was somehow featured in the Statue of Liberty was, he's jumping on the bandwagon.
Right.
Using the 9/11 theme. And so, knowing I'm going to be using the same work in the summer, I had to decide, you know, what do I just put it back out there. I ended up putting a statement, you know, a little artist statement saying this work had been completed before 9/11 and
right.
Has nothing, is not a reaction to those events. And I wonder, have you thought about this, how you'll handle that? Will you? Or just we just let it go?
Well, you know, what can I say? It's one of those things where I always say when I'm talking to people about like copyright issues in telecommunications, as a poet, I should pray that someone wants to steal it, you know? It's like, oh, please, let there be a controversy. What do I care? You know, at least beats being ignored. I mean, I think the job of the artist is to do what you do. And part of it is to look at the place that you're framed within. But, I mean, there's a reason why you were obsessed with the image. There's a reason why I was interested in this kind of project. I think that as an artist, the only way that you can approach it is to trust that your instincts are right and run with it. And, you know, it'll shake out how it's going to shake out. I think that my job is not to control how it's seen. That's the job of the audience. That's the job of the world, presuming that the world has any interest whatsoever.
So when you go to publish American Tarot, you won't slip in any little
No. Well, I mean, let's put it this way. If I slip in a footnote, does it somehow change the way that people are actually going to look at it? They're still going to read it in a post 9/11 world. I mean, you bring to the table what you bring to the table, I think, is how it works. If I were to, you know, if I'm to sit around and I'm to say, you know, well, World War II hadn't happened by the time that this, you know, thing was written, I mean, yeah, that's true, but it doesn't really change anything. I mean, in 10 years, which will probably be about how long it'll take me to finish the thing, the resonance will be different, so who knows? Anything else? No. Okay.
Is there a poem in that series actually called The Tower?
No, because there is a card called The Tower, so I'm intentionally not using anything that already exists. I mean, that would be a little too frightening if that were the case. Yeah. Twin Towers of Destruction? No, I don't think I want to go there somehow. The idea behind the project is that I don't want to use any of the existing ones at all. Kind of a challenge to come up with metaphors that set outside of that. Okay, last call for questions. Anybody else? Well, thank you all for coming.